parts of Australia, the blast was said to sound like gunfire. Its total power amounted to 200 megatons of TNT, or 13,000 little boy atomic bombs. Its noise level was measured to be 172 decibels 100 miles away and was calculated to be somewhere around 189 to 202 decibels from only 3 miles away. So things could get louder. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to what I probably will make my last story of tonight. It is kind of like a technological version of the proverbial man-eat-dog news story that the guidance computers aboard the Apollo 11 spacecraft were impossibly primitive compared to the pocket computers we all carry around now 50 years later and call our cell phones. But on a particular website, an Apple developer analyzed the technical specs even further and found that something as simple as a modern USB charger is packed with more processing power than the Apollo 11 guidance computers. The fellow broke down the numbers when it comes to the processing power, memory, and storage capacity of Google's 18-watt Pixel charger, Hawaii's 40-watt supercharge, Anchor's PowerPort, the Atom PD charger, and the Apollo 11 guidance computer, also referred as the AGC. It's not easy to directly compare these modern devices with 50-year-old AGC, which was custom developed by NASA for controlling and automating the guidance and navigation systems aboard Apollo 11 spacecraft. In a time when computers were the size of giant rooms, the AGC was contained in a box just a few feet in length, because it was one of the first computers to be made with integrated circuits. Instead of plopping in an off-the-shelf processor, NASA engineers designed and built the AGC with somewhere around 5,600 electronic gates that were capable of performing nearly 40,000 simple mathematical calculations every second. While we measure processor speeds in the gigahertz these days, the AGC chugged along at 1.024 megahertz. By comparison, the Anchor Power Atom PD2 USB-C charger includes a Cypress CYPD4225 processor running at 48 megahertz with twice the RAM of the AGC and almost twice the storage space for software instructions. There would be some challenges when it comes to making all the software powering the Apollo 11 spacecraft work on modern equipment, but on his site, Heller, the guy who's wrote this article, lays out the case of why he believes that just four of Anchor's USB chargers could have potentially helped take astronauts to the moon and back. Let me drop for a sec. However, going to space is not exactly a smooth ride. A rocket blasting off the pad is a much more different experience than to floor the gas pedal in a finely tuned sports car. Astronauts and the equipment that took them to space were not only subjected to intense G-forces. Apollo 11's top speed was over 24,000 miles per hour as it orbited the Earth before heading to the moon. But leaving Earth's orbit also exposed it to radiation and other challenges not experienced back on the ground. So, in other words, while a modern USB charger might have more processing power than the Apollo 11 guidance computer, it's doubtful that it could have survived that kind of a trip. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, nothing much heard. Just want to remind people, I want to thank everyone for participating, and even those people who didn't participate for listening to me. And I'll be back next week with a puzzler that I didn't use today. So it's always nice to have a puzzler in my pocket, and a lot of new stories. So once again, if you have any mailbag questions that you would like me to ask Dick, because you can't get onto the TechNet with a radio, or if you have anything that you would like to bring up to Paul, if you'd like to ask him a topic, a question, have him take a look at a website, what have you, or if you have anything for me, if you want to dispute something I've said, or give me some more information and offer me some references, or offer me a puzzle, or suggest a topic you'd like to discuss, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at ac2gs.com. And the stories that I talked about tonight, as always, will be available on my link page at roy.ac2gs.com. So once again, thank you for listening. Thank you for participating. Thanks, as always, to Dick and Paul for letting me join in on the fun. And now I shall pass it over to Paul for the space report.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good, Roy, on all of that. And we'll be going through a few of these topics here. And like always, if there's room at the end, I'm sure there's always something that you could probably fill in with. Don't have all that much. There was a launch that occurred yesterday at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport. They call it MARS. It's down in Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia, about 400 miles from here. And Northrop Grumman launched an Antares rocket with the Cygnus spacecraft on top, which is a cargo vehicle to go to the International Space Station. And this has been delayed two different times. They tried to get it off last week around this time, and then they delayed it because of a problem not with the rocket, but with the ground support equipment. And then they tried to make another launch on Friday, and they had upper wind problems. So they finally got it off on Saturday. I thought maybe the weather would be clear enough to see it. When they launch from there, you can see it from New York. Very low on the horizon, but not to be. But nevertheless, they had it on the NASA website, which was very good to watch. This rocket will be docking with the space station on Tuesday, and they got off successful. And I got feedback coming through this radio again. Not too annoying. Let me try the other review. Same thing here. What are you gonna do? Well, anyway, we'll try to get through this. The space station will be installed on the Unity module on the space station on Tuesday. You have Drew Morgan up there, NASA astronaut. He'll grab it with the Canadian robotic arm that's attached to the space station, and they'll berth it to the Zenith port, the port looking down from the space station. With 16 bolts, they have these 5/8-inch diameter bolts that have motors attached to them, and they automatically crank it in when it's attached. And they've done that many, many times. This is the 13th flight for Northrop Grumman, flying the Cygnus spacecraft to the space station with the Antares rocket. Three of the flights went by an Atlas V rocket when they were rebuilding redoing the Antares rocket some years ago when they had some problems with one of them that blew up. And Northrop Grumman now owns it. It used to be owned by Orbital ATK, but Northrop Grumman has taken over. So that was nice to watch. If you ever want to review a launch like that, they have it on YouTube. You just put in Atari's launch for yesterday's date, February 15th, and put in YouTube, and you can see the whole thing. Interesting. Somebody had an open mic too, as this thing was being counted down. You could hear somebody talking in the background, and they kept yelling out, "Open mic! Open mic!" Finally, they got a hold of it, and shut it down. But it did not scrub the launch. But somebody's going to hear about that. Okay. On another topic, there's a gigantic antenna. Probably a couple acres big in British Columbia that received signals from 500 light years away in a galaxy, and this is, they call these fast radio bursts, FRBs, and by the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment in British Columbia. And what's interesting about these is, you know, they're always looking for signals. It's radio astronomy. And they've heard these signals before, but this time they're repeating every 6 off and then shuts down, you know, and then 16 days, you know, every 16 days it comes back. And right away, of course, they're looking for little green men, but that's, you know, but they pretty much know that it's being caused by another phenomenon, probably a black hole or, you know, things revolving around a black hole. They really don't know yet. And this is WS2N. With a radio that's acting up. that's not good. That probably got worse. Did they move the mic around? No, it's not the mic. Anyway, there was a question last week about the Iranian launch. They tried to put another satellite into space from Iran, and it did not fail. It failed. It was not successful, fortunately, for them. It's their fourth failure in a row. They have done it before. It was about 5 years ago. They launched probably about 3 or 4 successful launches, but they have not been able to do it in a while. The liquid fuel rockets are relatively complicated. It's not like a solid fuel rocket. And it did not work out for them. Any questions or comments?
Steven, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, there's a new satellite or telescope that's been launched last December, the CHEOPS telescope. It's now in polar orbit, launched by European Space Agency from French Guiana on a Soyuz rocket, and it's called a characterizing exoplanet satellite. And it turns out they had first light, and that means that's the first time they test these things out. And apparently the pictures are better than what they expected. The idea of the this telescope is to actually look at the diameter of these exoplanets, which they don't really have a good idea of what they are. They know the mass and everything, but this is going to zoom in on it and be able to tell what the diameter is. And we're not going to be able to fix this radio tonight. That's not good. Well, not good. let's see if there's any questions or comments. Just stand by and bang this mic around. Can anybody tell me if that noise is coming through? Coming through on my speaker as I transmit. Very strange.
Yeah, Paul, about 30% noise.
Yeah, that's not good. I can't see how I can continue like this, Roy. I mean, I've had this problem on and off, but most of the times it tends to go away. I think this is getting worse.
We can hear you, Paul. Just keep going. I would agree. I could make out every single word. It's not that big a problem. Any of us who spend time on HF hear a lot more noise in the background.
Really? Okay. See, even if I lower the volume all the way, it has nothing to do with it. Very strange. Very strange. You know, it's like not coming through on the speaker. It has to do with the antenna. Believe it or not. They moved that coax around in the back. I'm going to have to investigate that PL-259. I think I might have something to do with that. I think I got it.
It sounds much, much better now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's no time to experiment with it. Wow. Let me drop it.
there's the Virgin Galactic Company, and that's run by Richard Branson, and he successfully now flew his Starship 2 to New Mexico from Mojave Desert out in California, which is the, his goal is to eventually send people to suborbital space on Spaceship 2. He plans on putting 6 passengers on with the pilot and a co-pilot, and he will, that should take place probably this year. He's got to run quite a few tests, but I saw pictures of this thing landing in New Mexico. They have a spaceport out there. It's called Spaceport America. And Spaceport America has this White Knight 2. That's a carrier plane with 4 jet engines on it that's able to lift this thing and fly it all the way, you know, anywhere around the globe, really, to land in any airport. And once this thing gets developed, they'll be able to charge $250,000 a piece to launch on this. You have 600 people that have signed up, and that was about 4 years ago. He hasn't taken any more people on. You know, on those people still are going to fly on this thing probably within this year. He's got three other Spaceship 2s being built, manufacturing them, and he will be bringing those online as well, and plans on launching from different parts of the world. This is a guy that a couple of months ago he put himself on a stock exchange, and since then he's doubled his money. People have poured money into the system, so it's really the first face type of tourist type of company that has made it to the stock market. We'll see how he does. He's got competition from Jeff Bezos, the owner of Blue Origin. Jeff Bezos, he's the owner of Amazon, but he's got this Blue Origin company that he's building. From Blue Origin, that space company is constructing the new Shepard. Shepard is going to be also suborbital. And he'll be able to launch people from Texas. He's got a launch complex set up. Successfully launches the new Shepard with the booster. The crew would be on top in a capsule. They would separate. They'd have about 5-7 minutes in space on a suborbital flight, 0G, and they'd come back down and land on parachutes. The booster comes down and lands vertically the way they took off. And then, of course, that will be reusable. So, that's pretty good. Okay. Anyway, on to another topic. Unless somebody has a question, this is WS2M.
WA2MHL. Name's Bob. Have a question.
Okay, Bob, go right ahead. WA2MHL, WS2M.
I was wondering if the rocket that was launched by Iran could be weaponized at all. Does it present any possibility of becoming a weapon we should be watching out for?
Most likely, no, not with the liquid. You know, they have a liquid rocket, liquid oxygen. You know, with the solid booster system, you know, yes, they could. These things are unreliable to launch on time or accurately, you know, unless you really develop them like the United States did with the Titan rockets. But this thing is, I would say, not reliable. They do plan on launching a solid booster rocket a couple of months from now. Now, that could be a problem. Back to you, Bob.
WA2MHL, thank you very much. Appreciate your answer back. Speak to you later.
Yeah, Bob. I've been following it a little bit with the with their progress. Yeah, I mean, they don't think like we do. I mean, if you go down there, the name of their spaceport is the Khomeini Spaceport. You know, pictures, gigantic pictures on the side of it. Side of the launch complex of that guy, and just a different world. And they are trying. You know, I mean, this is. I think this is going to be some kind of communication satellite. I don't think it worked out. Got a coax problem. See, if I lift up on the back of the radio here, it goes by. I'm going to take this apart tomorrow. Okay, I've talked about Rocket Lab before. Rocket Lab has. Developed a rocket called the Electron rocket, and they've been launching successfully. And he built the launch complex in New Zealand. He's originally from New Zealand. This guy Peter Beck. I guess he's got about 10 launches under his belt so far. And these things are liquid fueled rocket turbines. They're not run by any kind of combustion system. He's got electric motors. You know, each one's got like 50 horsepower behind it. And using these electric motors with lithium-ion batteries to drive these turbines. So he's able to make it relatively cheap. And he could launch like, you know, every couple of months. His goal is eventually to do one, like one launch a week. So he's building another launch complex. It's pretty much finished. In Wallops Island, Virginia, the same location that the Cygnus Antares launched from yesterday. They let him build a launch complex there. I mean, you know, his company is in California, so his rockets are built and developed in California. So he has gone ahead and started signing contracts to launch satellites from that location, and he plans on his second launch, he's going to launch CubeSat for NASA all the way to the moon. And you got to remember, this thing's going to go off like $9 million. You know, it's very inexpensive compared to, let's say, SpaceX. It's supposed to be cheap when they do a launch. It's $62 million. Three times that amount for an Atlas rocket with United Launch Alliance. So it's pretty cheap to do a lunar flight, an orbital flight from an Electron rocket, and that will go into a rectilinear orbit, which is, instead of being like 60 miles above the surface of the moon, it's going to be like 40,000 miles. High and like maybe 1,000 miles low, you know, highly elliptical orbit. And why do they want to do that? They're going to duplicate the orbit that NASA plans on putting a space station called the Gateway into that particular orbit, and leaving there and leaving a crew on station. I mean, that's their ultimate goal. You know, they want to get to the moon. But they want to do it with this Gateway system that they're developing. So, this guy, Peter Beck, has got the contract for that. And, I mean, they plan on eventually launching, you know, maybe 10 rockets a year from that complex. And maybe another 10 or 20 from New Zealand. I mean, this is the way it's going. There's a lot of companies, startup companies that are coming down the pike to launch small satellites. I mean, CubeSat for AM radio. You know, they'll be able to do this on a regular basis. As it is, there's probably at least two or three launches per week the way things are going. You know, between suborbital and orbital flights. Point where I used to be able to keep up with them now they're starting to get away from me. There's so many flights. So the next big flight for the United States is going to be by SpaceX, and that will be this year, probably in, I'm going to guess, May. They think maybe April, where they'll be able to launch a crew on the Dragon, Crew Dragon vehicle. Has now been finally delivered to Florida. That will be eventually put on top of a Falcon 9 rocket and launch from Launch Complex 39A, same complex that they used to launch shuttles from in Saturn V. So that's going to be big news. That will be a turning point for U.S. I mean, you know, we haven't launched anything since, what, 2011 with Atlantis, shut down the space shuttle system. They're going to have two people on board to begin with. I believe it's going to be Doug Hurley and Bob Mencken. So their goal will be to dock with the space station and spend a couple of weeks and then come back. And if that works out okay, yeah, next flight will go up with a larger crew, and they'll be able to permanently staff the International Space Station. Right now, there's only three people on board the space station, or six on a regular basis, but three just came back, including Christina Cook, who spent almost a year on station. Now they have just three. There'll be another three going up soon, and then late April, the three that are up there now will be coming back, and then you'll just have three on station all the way until one of these vehicles, either SpaceX with Dragon or with Boeing, the Starliner, and they'll be here. I think, you know, they've got some problems. I think, you know, there was a competition between SpaceX and Boeing, who was going to go up first, the Starliner vehicle or the Crew Dragon. Looks like Crew Dragon's going to win out right now. Starliner had some problems. They ran a test. They sent an unmanned vehicle to the International Space Station. It didn't make it. Computer problems, timing problems, trying to work through the software. There's like a million lines of code that they have to go through to try to figure out what the problem is. But they think they got a handle on it. And hopefully it works out. But maybe by the end of the year, they might be able to send the crew up. But it looks like SpaceX is going to win out. And my guess is probably May. They're saying April. I hope it is. But it looks like it's going to be April. This is WS. Okay, I really don't have any other topics. I told Roy I didn't have all that much. Hey, at least I got my radio fixed. I know I'm going to take this PL-259 apart and see what's going on with that. As I move that around, things change. Right now, I got it quiet. I'm going to turn it back to Roy and see if he has any further information. Or if not, we'll shut down. AC2GS, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. I always have material. I don't know why, but I have a lot of material. And so I will just continue until we hit 11 o'clock, which is the witching hour for us. So let me drop for a second, and I will continue. Okay, apparently these home genetic test companies are dropping like veritable flies these days. Ancestry has announced that it had to lay off 6% of its workforce, or around 100 workers, due to a slowdown in consumers' demand across the entire DNA category over the past year and a half. The news comes just a few weeks after 23andMe, another DNA testing service, revealed that it cut 100 workers because of dwindling sales as well. Ancestry chief Margot Georgiadis touched upon one of the reasons for the company's shrinking sales in her blog post. Most early adopters have already entered the category. Another possible reason is that people are becoming more concerned about the privacy implications of taking DNA tests and then sharing their genetic information. authorities have started using DNA testing services to solve cold cases in recent years. And interest in the method grew even further after it led to the arrest of the Golden State Killer. It's worth noting, though, that the Ancestry tries to protect its customers' privacy. It even fought a police DNA data search warrant last year and won. Whatever the reason for the company's sales decline is, Ancestry must now think of a new way to stay in business, as Georgiadis said in her post. Quote, future growth will require a continued focus on building consumer trust and innovative new offerings that develop even greater value to the people. Ancestry is well positioned to lead that innovation to inspire additional discoveries in both family history and health. But on the bright side, Ouija board sales tripled a few years ago, so home genetic testing might become popular again one of these days. Who knows? Anyway, let me drop pretty questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. What do you do when you decide to sell people on technology that isn't quite ready for prime time? Well, since foldable phones are still far from common, a lot of potential buyers want to know how durable they are before shelling out money for one, especially because the available models are far from cheap. CNET has put the new Motorola Razr to the test by folding it repeatedly for thousands of times using a machine called the FoldBot, made by SquareTrade. The result? Its hinges started to act rather wonky by around 27,000 folds. To note, a 2017 study found that Americans check their phones 80 times a day. So that means the Razr could start showing problems within about a year. Last year, CNET conducted the same test on the Samsung Galaxy Fold, which lasted for 14 hours, or 119,380 folds on its machine. The FoldBot was actually designed to test the Samsung device, but the publication had it modified for the Razr with the goal of reaching 100,000 folds. However, the host of the live stream had to cut the test short when the phone's hinge started to make strange noises and was showing resistance after only about 4 hours. It also looked uneven and out of alignment when the phone is closed. That said, the Razr screen still worked and looked just fine even after its hinge started to give out. The Galaxy Fold screen itself broke by the end of its test, but then again it lasted much longer and the machine was calibrated to fold it all the way through each time. For Razr's test, the machine only folded the device halfway. There's an old line that people shouldn't do something just because they can. I think it follows that they really shouldn't do something just because they can't. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, Doc, on to the next. The next generation of atom smashers could be 100 kilometers or 62-mile round ring, costing over $10 billion. With no promise of finding something as glamorous as last decade's Higgs boson. But does the future of physics need to be so large? What if researchers could probe the secrets of the smallest particles using technology that was smaller? Scientists have just overcome one of the greatest challenges standing in the way of producing a more efficient kind of particle accelerator, one that would accelerate an unstable particle called a muon. A muon collider could potentially probe a much higher energy frontier with a smaller footprint and for less money than a city-circling collider based on current technology. It seems convincing that a muon collider that can compete with this future hadron collider would be a lot cheaper, Daniel Kaplan, a particle physicist at the Illinois Institute of Technology, told reporters. Kaplan leads the consortium of U.S. collaborators on the muon ionization cooling experiment. Particle colliders today look for new subatomic particles, search for new insights into how particles interact with one another, and test theories about how our universe works. They do so by accelerating two classes of particles, either protons, the clumps of protons in the form of ions, or electrons and their antiparticle positrons, smashing them together inside a detector. But these particles have their drawbacks. Protons are composed of substructures called quarks, so information is lost on the collision, as it's hard to keep track of what collided with what and caused what end product. Electrons don't have any known internal structure, but they do produce radiation when they change direction, meaning that an efficient electron accelerator must be straight and long. Let me drop for a sec. Muons solve some of these problems. They're point particles like electrons, but they're 200 times more massive, and they don't release as much radiation when they change direction. But muons come with their own problems that make them difficult to work with. They decay into other particles in around 2 microseconds. And the way physicists produce muons, crashing a proton beam into a target to produce muons directly, as well as another particle called a pion that decays into muons, creates more of a spray of randomly moving particles than a beam. Getting a tightly packed source of muons that's usable in experiments requires a way to align the spray into a beam before the muons decay. A few weeks ago, physicists from the muon ionization cooling experiment, MICE, announced the results of a 20-year-long engineering effort and decades of theoretical work. The proof of concept showed the first steps in creating a muon beam using a method called ionization cooling. Ionization cooling takes the randomly moving muons and passes them through a cooling apparatus. The apparatus consists of 12 superconducting coils that generate magnetic fields, which surround a 22-liter vessel of liquid hydrogen with aluminum windows that the muon pass through. The muons then transfer energy to the hydrogen atoms by ionizing them, i.e. knocking electrons off of them, and emerge on the other side of the apparatus to a collimated beam. Radio frequency cavities and magnets could then accelerate the beam to the energies required for physics experiments. Theoretical physicists first devised the ionization cooling method in the late 1970s and early 80s, but the challenges were difficult to overcome, explained Chris Rogers, physicist at the STFC Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, where the MICE experiment was being carried out. Quote, "It's a massive engineering challenge, given the kinds of magnetic fields we need to generate," Rogers said. It wasn't until the early 2000s that physicists actually considered constructing such a device. Part of what motivated them was the increased interest in neutrinos, a kind of subatomic particle that barely interacts with matter, but is the subject of some physicists' most pressing questions today. Muons decay into neutrinos, so a muon beam in turn could be very useful as a neutrino beam. Let me drop for a sec. MICE researchers began taking data in 2012, finished taking data in 2017, and analyzed the data for 2 years. Their analysis measured the beam before and after the cooling system, demonstrating that the system had the intended effect and really did remove some of the random motion of the muons, according to a paper published in Nature. Other physicists who were not involved in MICE were excited about this experimental tour de force. Quote, "I'm really glad to see this," said Heidi Shellman, a particle physicist at Oregon State University. She was especially impressed by their ability to harness such powerful magnets, which can quench, if not controlled properly, cause damage to equipment. Shellman said that she was excited to see the technology's potential applications in neutrino science. Cooling the beam was perhaps the main challenge in the way of realizing a muon accelerator, but there's more to be done. The researchers only demonstrated that the cooling method works and have yet to create the kind of beam needed for a full-scale collider. Once they do that, physicists can look to design more cost-efficient colliders based on this design. But the discovery is an exciting one in its own. Quote, "What excites me the most is the new capability we have," Rogers said, that we showed that it can prepare a new particle for acceleration. Particle accelerators are already used in physics experiments, medicine, and other applications. Maybe these muons will allow for applications that physicists haven't quite thought of yet. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next. No, this next story isn't a repeat of one of the many previous reports of Boeing's 737 MAX snafus. This is a brand new one. Engineers at Boeing have discovered a new software issue with the 737 MAX plane, which has been grounded worldwide for almost a year over technical issues. The new problem, first reported by Bloomberg News, involves the trim system, which regulates whether the nose of the aircraft is pointed up or down. A light for the trim system wasn't going off when it should, according to the company. Quote, during flight testing of the 737 MAX's updated software, an indicator light associated with the stabilizer trim system illuminated in the flight deck, a Boeing spokesperson told reporters. Quote, we determined that the illumination of this light was caused by differences in input data between the flight control computers. This is a result of the flight control computer cross-compare redundancy software update issued in June 2019, he said. Quote, we are incorporating a change in the 737 MAX software prior to the fleet returning to service to ensure that this indicator light only illuminates as intended, the aviation company statement continued. Boeing notified the Federal Aviation Administration this past week of the June 20th finding and has shared technical background regarding the issue and planned software update. Quote, we have also notified our airline customers, end quote. Boeing, which hopes to have the 737 back in service by the middle of this year, has faced scandal after scandal following two crashes with the MAX plane just 5 months ago. 5 months apart, rather. Ethiopian Airline Flight 302 crashed in Ethiopia on March 10th, 2019, killing all 157 passengers and crew on board. And Lion Air Flight 610 crashed in Indonesia on October 29th, 2018, killing all 189 people on board. The plane's new maneuvering characteristic augmentation system was reportedly forcing the nose of the plane down erroneously because it believed the plane was in danger of crashing. Let me drop for a second. The FAA and Boeing grounded every 737 MAX operating in the United States in March of 2019, but only after almost every other country in the world that was operating the aircraft grounded the plane on its own. Boeing fired its CEO in December following the seemingly never-ending series of scandals with the MAX plane. Other recent Boeing headlines have involved a series of emails from employees saying things like, quote, this airplane is designed by clowns who in turn are supervised by monkeys, end quote. And the FAA knew about the problem almost from the beginning. Despite yet another problem with the plane, Steve Dixon, the head of Federal Aviation Administration, seemed optimistic that the plane would return to service, according to Reuters, and has previously suggested that it might be up in the sky before mid-2020. The only question that remains is whether passengers will want to fly on the doomed plane. United and Southwest have already announced that they'll allow passengers the ability to opt out of flying on the 737 MAX. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I wonder if there's a connection between the software problems with these jet planes and, you know, Boeing is the one that's making up all the software for the Starliner. That's the spacecraft that's supposed to eventually bring crews to the International Space Station. I just wonder if there's some kind of connection. I wonder if they have the same people that do the software. You know, it's just, I guess it's, you know, it could be a coincidence, but you start to wonder.
Yes, it's difficult to know. It depends upon how they organize their different departments, if they segregate software development into different categories, or if there's one big place that does it all. Things have been somewhat lax. I get the sense that what's been happening over the last 10-odd years is the government regulatory agencies have sort of said, you've been doing this for a long time, you check your own work. And unfortunately, you can't do that with many people. Not everyone is going to be as tough on themselves as some other guy. So I think it's endemic in the lack of regulation, the lack of overview for Boeing, that they've just kind of gone down a drain someplace. So I hope they get their act together. I mean, You know, they're the epitome of some company that's too big to fail. But they're doing a good impersonation of a company failing.
Yeah, I know they bought up other companies over the years. You know, these companies are successful. They buy them up. Wonder
that
what
time
happened.
Complete.
There's only so much of that that you do before you start winding up with problems. Something going on with Boeing. But yeah, I'm wondering if they're going to get their Starliner. Never mind those airplanes back up, even this year. All right. Thanks for that, Roy.
You're welcome, Paul. Economically speaking, we're in a strange time when consolidation seems to be the way to go. Again, regulatory agencies are kind of lax these days. They're not really interested in monopolies. You know, they configure them as vertical monopolies, which the government tolerates. And so you have a lot of companies buying up smaller companies. You see it almost every day. You know, I give you in the entertainment industry as a perfect example, Disney. I mean, eventually Disney's going to own every single film, television show, and even podcast.
Okay, yeah, I see that. I see that's happening. But you see, Boeing bought up Northwell and Rockwell. Well, actually, it was Northwell and Rockwell were separate and became Northwell Rockwell, and then eventually Boeing took that over. And Rockwell was the one that, you know, they built the Saturn V rocket and all of that. And the command modules. They didn't build the LEM, you know, that was Grumman. But they're still separate. Grumman is still Northrop Grumman. Boeing, I don't know. I guess maybe after 100 years of operation or so, you start to have problems.
You know, companies are like human beings. They have a birth, they have a lifespan, and unfortunately, they have a death. And no company, to my knowledge, has survived and become immortal. They all have an arc. I tend to like competition. I find competition tends to be healthy, and so I prefer an industry where there's more than one or two guys in it, because with one guy you get nothing. With two guys you don't really get much competition. You tend to get them a wink and a nudge, and they go along with each other's plan. You throw 15 people and 15 different organizations into that pile, you're going to get one scrapper who's going to take no business from them. But I don't know. We're in a strange economic cycle, a weird business trend that I hope we break free of. I think it's time to break up Bell Labs one more time. You know, AT&T. It worked well the first time. I think it will work just as well the second.
Okay, yeah, forgot about that. I think of the rocket people. You know, remember Morton Salt? You know, Morton Salt with the girl with the umbrella and, you know, little blue container. That eventually got bought up by Thiokyle, and you had Morton Thiokyle. They're the ones that built the big solid booster engines. The rocket engines for the space shuttle, and of course look what happened there with the Challenger. But they straightened it out. They were still okay, but then as time went by, they became, you know, Orbital Science they bought them up. Orbital Science decided to let's launch rockets. So they're the ones building these Antari rockets that I talked about that went up yesterday, but you know, not under that name anymore. Orbital Science became Orbital ATK. ATK is the ones that, you know, they make bullets and rounds for, you know, ammunition. They bought them up and they gobbled them up, and now that all belongs to Northrop Grumman. So, you know, I wonder when they're going to reach their PETA principle, if you've ever read that. I wonder when they're going to get, you know, to their level of incompetence. Back to you, Roy.
For all we know, these companies like Boeing might have reached them. You never quite know until it's after the fact, and then you read the book and hear the terrible stories. It's that's what business is. It's messy. It's complicated because it involves human beings, and us human beings tend to be complicated. I'll let you go on. Just WS2N. Okay, I mean, we're past our little witching hour. My little clock says 11:05, and we were supposed to say nighty-night to everyone by 11. So I want to take this opportunity once again for the next time to remind everyone that if they have any mailbag questions that they would like Dick to address during the first segment of the TechNet, or if they have anything that they would like me to pass to a Paul, either a story or a website or a topic or a question, or if you have anything for me, if you have any topics of a technical nature, scientific nature that you would like me to kind of wax poetic on, or if you have any thing that I said that sounds wrong to you, if you could cite references, I always like to see that. Or if you got any puzzles for me, I'm perpetually looking for puzzles. So please, for any of those choices, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all of these stories, including the new ones that I just told you, will be available for you to click on and read for yourself over on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com. So once again, I, as always, want to thank the participants who talk up and bring up interesting facts to me and questions and answers and all kinds of things. To those who listen quietly, that's fine as well. And to Dick and to Paul for giving me this opportunity. So I will wish everyone a happy and healthy week, and say 73, and I'll be clear and pass it over for Paul.
Very good. Well, have a good night, and back on the air tomorrow night, because that's the club information net for Limewalk. And everybody can check in, find out what's new with Limewalk and what's going on with them. And you don't have to be a member. But we'll be here next week, 73 WS to answer.
AC2GS from WB2GXM.
That's Rich.
I was very interested in that comparison between the computer that powered our trip to the moon versus the USB charging power exceeding it today. I have a personal story.
Sure.
I've been working with computers throughout my career. In fact, currently in my printing job, I have two computers staring me in the face for 8 hours a day at least. One of them a fully decked out current Mac, and the other one a fully decked out Windows 10 computer. However, let me drop. In the good old days, I've been involved with electronic music for a long time too. Electronic music people will undoubtedly remember the company PAIA. Or PAIA. PAIA was run by John Simonton, and they produced electronic kits, one of which was a computer designed to power one of their keyboards, which I bought both of. The computer was a kit. It was a build-it computer. I actually soldered together the entire computer, which had 1K of memory. 1K. It did not even have a keyboard. It had a capacitive touch keypad of 16 buttons. I spent many a winter's evening programming that thing out of a magazine. If I didn't have one hand on the radiator, the thing wouldn't work because it had to have a correct ground. Let me drop. Fond memories which will never be repeated again, brought back by your story. AC2GS, WB2GXM.
Very good. That was a great one, Rich. I got into computers relatively late in the 80s. My first computer was an Atari 800 XL, but I was one of those young people who subscribed to Popular Electronics, And when the Altair, the first kit microcomputer came out, I lusted after that thing. What I would have done with it is anyone's guess, because it barely did anything. And if you remember it, and I'm sure you do, you had to load a bootloader into it using the toggle switches on the front. Not quite as tedious as the way that you had to do yours. My Atari 800 had incredible 48K of memory. Now, I think the one that I'm staring at right now has 32 gigabytes of memory. So it only goes to show you how far things have gone.
It blows your mind in a wonderful way to think about it all.
Indeed, and I like that it progressed the way that it did. I think that in retrospect, sort of knowing how my brain worked, if someone brought me a spec sheet for the latest and greatest computer back to the 1980s, it would have somehow depressed me until I reached here. So I'm glad that technology, steadily goes better and better and better. And I still remember annoying a salesperson trying to sell me a hard drive, something like 1982, 84, probably about 84, something like 2 megabytes of hard drive space for only $2,000 and change, and me suggesting that that's a wee bit too expensive. Can you imagine how much, if you could possibly get a 2 megabyte thumb drive, they wouldn't sell it to you because it would just be worth so little. I think the cheapest one I've seen lately is a couple of gigabytes.
Well, very recently, you could fit the entire operating system of a Commodore 64 computer, which I also have, on one of those little cards the size of your thumbnail.
Yeah, I am fascinated beyond belief with things like the micro SD card, where you have these little teeny things smaller than your thumbnail, and the darn thing can hold 256 gigabytes. I just can't wrap my brain around it even these days, seeing all the great things, all the technological toys. I mean, there's more to life than technology, and every so often someone smacks me in the head. I do these TechNet things, and yet I have people telling me, technology isn't that important, but, it's a TechNet. You're supposed to talk about technology. If it was, God forbid, a religion net, you'd sort of need to talk about religion, but neither here nor there. It always amazes me. I am never bored by technological advances. I always find it exciting.
Well, I do too, and thank you for listening to my little tale. I'm glad you guys are there. AC2GS, WB2GXO.
Welcome, Rich. Always a pleasure. These nights are the high point of my week, especially when I can kind of engage with other people's minds, and like I said before, maybe I can teach someone something, but maybe someone can teach me as well. So these are very rewarding times for me, so I'm enjoying it as well.
She never had.
I think I will let you all go, and I will go. Have a WB2GX, I'm clear.
Rich, this is AC2GS, clear.
AD2LXK clear.
Is the DeWatt?
Hello? Why does it sound like that?
Sector insurance.
Hello? Testing.